Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This episode of Talk Nerdy is sponsored by NatureBox. NatureBox ships tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, like honey barbecue crunch, double berry fruit peels, and chocolate chia granola, you will never get bored of snacking again. Try NatureBox for free by going to naturebox.com/talknerdy. That's naturebox.com/talknerdy. I want to take a moment to give a shout out to everybody who supported the podcast this week in the many cool ways that you do. First and foremost, on Patreon, the patrons of Talk Nerdy, those of you who go to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support, I want to give a shout out to kind of our large pledgers there. First and foremost, thank you so much to Zachary Moroccan, and I sent you your treat in the mail. Hopefully you will receive it soon. I know that you're in the UK, so it may take a little while to go across the pond there. I also want to thank Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell. Over on PayPal, I want to thank Atomic Insights for your really incredible donation and your very sweet note about last week's episode with Kevin Folta. That was a really fun podcast, and I was really excited about all of the amazing feedback that I got on that one. I also want to thank those of you who have visited carasantamaria.com and shown your support in the many ways that you do, going to the store and shopping around, clicking on the banner at the very top with the brand new t-shirt that's for sale through Compass 120. It's a signature series t-shirt, so it has a quote from me and then my signature at the bottom of the tee, and it's designed all cool. I really like it. They did a great job with it. So thank you for those of you who have gone to my website and checked that out. And again, thank you for those of you who spread the word, rating and reviewing on iTunes and Stitcher, and also just telling your friends about the show. It really does mean a lot. All right, guys, I'm really excited about this week's episode. This is one of my most requested guests up to this point, and it's always fun for me to sit down and do an episode in person with somebody I haven't met in real life before but only follow on Twitter. So this was a really fun one. She is the host of the Congressional Dish podcast. Here she is, Jennifer Briney. Well, Jen, thank you so much for joining me to talk nerdy today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to meet you.
I'm so excited. I love it when I get to do a podcast with somebody that I haven't met before and I get to know them on air. Mm. It's weird, but it's really fun. I'm also excited because you're not local. So, I mean, you're semi-local, but you live in NorCal now.
I'm former local. Former I was raised here and I went to college here, but I haven't lived here since 2008.
I have to say, I was just having this conversation with my associate producer on one of the shows I work on, and she is also from here. She moved to the Bay. She came back, and now she's going to go back to the Bay. And I was saying how I find native Angelenos, that's what they call themselves, guys, I find it just such an odd thing that there are people that were born in Southern California. I don't know why.
I wasn't born in Southern California. We moved here when I was six from Denver. Yeah, it was close enough. I was raised here.
Yeah.
So it is a weird upbringing, especially when it comes to like celebrity culture and stuff. And now I was raised to be afraid of it, you know, that I don't want people knowing who I am. So I have a fear of being famous where other people chase it, where this is like the biggest downside of my job.
Yeah. And when you say other people chase it, like that's not just a generalism. Like here in LA, like that's what everybody does.
They chase it.
Everybody. Like, yeah. It does feel like almost everyone you meet is somehow connected to film or television or publicity, like somehow in that kind of a world. And also another weird thing is it's not just about, it's so loud here. I love it. It's like, it starts within like the first minute of the podcast. There's like motorcycle, whatever. It's not just about the celebrity culture, the wealth in SoCal and the, I guess the kind of focus on showing your wealth is very different than it is in other parts of the country. And that's one thing when I talk to people who are born and raised here, they always say when they leave, they say like, I don't know why. I just thought that like everyone drove a BMW. Mm-hmm. Like, because that's what it feels like when you grow up. This is something that I don't know how to stress enough. I grew up in Texas, which was, you know, I grew up in Dallas, which is nice. Actually in Plano, which is a very nice suburb of Dallas. But it's just not the same. Like, there are pockets of wealth, and then there are normal people. Like, it's a normal part of the country. And when you drive around Southern California, if you didn't know any better, you would think that, like, a BMW must cost $12,000, because everybody drives an Audi, a Beamer, a Lexus, a whatever. And there's, like, Maseratis. There are... I don't even know what nice cars are. Like, there's Ferraris, there's Lamborghini, they're all over the place here. Yeah. It's weird.
It's shocking. It's, my mother actually called it when we first moved here, because she's from Boston. And so when we first moved here, she was disturbed by, she would go into people's houses, which were huge, and they had the expensive car in the yard, and they were always dressed in designer clothes. But you go in the house and it's bare. There's nothing in there, because they're spending all their money on showy stuff that they really don't have any left. And it's funny, because a friend of mine actually comes from real money. He calls everyone in Southern California new money.
Yeah.
Because we blow it all. And the people that have real money, they drive Volvos and shop at Kohl's, because it's a great deal, you know? Like, Marshall's in Boston is huge amongst everyone, because it's fashionable stuff for reasonable prices. And around here, the places that people shop, like, I just found it really tough to live here and try and keep up with the Joneses, because...
You can't. You just have to, like, change your priorities when you live here. I mean, I'm lucky enough that I didn't grow up here, and so I didn't have to, like, I can't imagine being a little kid and having that in your head all the time. It's so competitive. It's so, like, it's just, it seems so easy. I think that's what it is. So many people are trying to put up a front, like they're so successful when they're actually working really hard at it, but it comes across like it's easy for them. And so then you're like, well, I can't imagine. I'm sure that if I grew up here, I would be like a total brat. And I'd be like, Mom and Dad, why didn't you buy me a BMW? And they'd be like, because I'm a school teacher. Like, I don't understand. But luckily I didn't have that. So when they were like, yeah, if you want a car, you're going to buy it yourself. And I was like, oh, shit. Like, that's kind of what all my friends had to do too.
Yeah.
And that's when you end up driving a $500 car, which is quite reliable, let me tell you.
Yeah. It's nice to grow up here and leave and see that the whole world actually isn't like this. And it's been really freeing for me to just not worry about my clothes anymore, or my hair, or any of that stuff. You know, it's the podcast and now having to do some, like, television type stuff that's bringing me back into caring, because I kind of have to.
Yeah, but you can go, like, the Michael Kors route and just wear the same thing every day.
Which I do.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's like, if he can get away with wearing a black t-shirt and a black blazer every time he's in public, like, we can do that too.
Yeah. I have, like, three nice outfits that I wear when I have to, and then the rest of the time it's yoga pants, and
I love it.
Perfectly happy with it. And that's one nice thing that is I am enjoying about the Bay Area is clothes don't matter. People just wear what they wear and they're comfortable, and it's been nice up there.
I love Oakland. I love it. Love it. Love it. Like, I like Oakland a lot more than San Francisco. Like, I know it has dark, you know, a dark seedy underbelly, same as Hollywood. Like, there are parts that are dangerous. There are places where there are people who are really suffering. And for some people, that's like a turnoff to their city. Obviously, it's something that I want to address, and I want to fix, and I want to change, and I want to be involved in. But I also like how dynamic places like Oakland are, where you get to meet people from every walk of life, people who have totally different opinions about things. And it just has a fun vibe. I don't know. I have a harder time in San Francisco. That's a hard city for me. But Oakland is very inviting to me for some reason.
Well, my husband's job that brought us up there is in San Francisco. So originally I went there, and it was more of a financial decision. I had 2 days to find a place. So I took 1 day in San Francisco and 1 day in Oakland. And they were going to charge me $3,400 for a first floor, one bedroom with no light. And I work from home. I hardly ever leave. And it was just depressing. So I found a one bedroom in a tower in Oakland on the 12th floor with plenty of natural light for $3,100. So it's still painful to even think about paying that much in rent. But Oakland was just obvious for me for financial reasons. And now that I've been there 6 months and I've had time to experience both cities, I'm more comfortable in Oakland. It's something more relaxed about it, and there's more nature there.
It feels more like it's not suburban at all, but it feels more like neighborhoody to me than San Francisco. San Francisco is like mini New York, so that can be tough. I have to point out that I'm sure there are people who are listening to the podcast in like Idaho or Nebraska or even Texas whose jaws just hit the floor when you said how much you have to.
I know.
It's insane. I mean, even here in Hollywood, I think I pay $2,500 in rent. Granted, my place is big. I got a good deal.
Yeah, this is
but
a good place.
Yeah, that's just like, that's a good deal in LA. When I lived in Texas, when I was in graduate school, I lived in a 3-bedroom house for $800 a month.
You know, I can't even fathom
it's insane.
That.
Like my mother's mortgage is, I want to say, 1/5 of my rent.
That's
my
madness.
Mother's mortgage for her home. It's just.
But we're also moving because I can't continue to pay that and keep doing the podcast full time. So mm-hmm. we're moving a little bit more inland to Walnut Creek. And
oh,
my
nice.
Husband's going to have a little bit more of a ride on the subway. But
well, and that's really a decision that a lot of people have to make, even when they don't live in big, incredibly expensive cities like New York, L.A., San Francisco. A lot of people make that decision. They're in the city, whether it's, you know, Raleigh or Dallas or whatever. And then you might start to move out to the suburbs when you realize, like, yeah, I'd like to have more space. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm spending a lot of money for very little when I live in the city. And so it's really about, I think for a lot of people, it's about lifestyle. It's about, do you have kids? It's about, what is your day-to-day like? I'm still definitely a city girl. I'm not complaining. Everything's very expensive. I am complaining. But I'm not really complaining because I choose it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I could move back to Texas, but I don't want to. Anyway, it was a long aside. I'm so excited to have you here because, A, I'm excited to finally meet you in person. B, okay, a lot of my fans and listeners and viewers and everything will reach out to me via social media and they'll say, what podcast do you listen to? What are some recommendations? And then I'm very remiss because I have to always say, I don't really listen to podcasts. I'm like the worst podcaster because I podcast, but I'm not one of those people who ever remembers to listen. It just doesn't fit my lifestyle that much to listen to podcasts. And, but I tend to make my recommendations based on the ones that I have heard and that I like, the ones that I think fit with, you know, my interests, and the ones that people who I really trust and like recommend. And let me tell you, you are by far the most requested guest on my show, and your podcast has been recommended to me by more people than anybody else.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm really thrilled to have you here because I really want to talk about.
That is so exciting.
Yeah,
thank you.
I want to talk about your process. I want to talk about, you know, why you do what you do. And I love politics. I love it, but it's kind of like my secondary passion. I'm science first. For me, I think there's so much interplay, but for some reason, it does feel like in this kind of media and in this kind of culture, you have to sort of pick what it is that you do. And I'm trying to branch out a little more, so I think I could learn a lot from you too. So again, let me say welcome. And for people who are listening who maybe don't know, who are not the percentage of my listeners who actually told me to try and get you on the show, why don't you let people know what the Congressional Dish is all about?
So for Congressional Dish, I started this 2.5 years ago where I just decided to read all of the bills that passed the House of Representatives for one whole Congress, which is 2 years long, because it occurred to me over many years of trying to figure out what's going on in the world that I knew nothing about the branch of government that's supposed to represent me. And so to figure out what was going on, I figured, well, no one is reading these bills. Everybody talks about that. So I'll be the person that does that. It's one thing that I can contribute because it's information that I'm having trouble finding myself. So starting in 2013.
Is it? I see 2012 on your website.
Well, I did about 3 months at the end of the 112th Congress just to kind of get used to podcasting and figure out what I was doing.
That was smart of you.
Yeah, smart of you. There's a little extra there.
But yeah, they're 18 from 2013. Or I'm sorry, 81. Yeah, there's a lot. So.
Well, and okay. I started doing it weekly because what happened is it started out very slow. I didn't know if there was even going to be a podcast long term because from January to about April of 2013, they barely worked at all.
Oh, yeah. This was the Do Nothing Congress,
the
as we know.
The Do Nothing Congress. Yeah. And that was the reputation. So I thought maybe there's nothing here. And then summer came along and I just got blasted with these super long bills. And then when you read these really long ones that end up becoming law, there's a shocking amount of stuff in there that's clear corporate favors. So I started this just looking into, I don't know what's going to be in here. I just want to know. So I'll do this out loud. And over the course of the last 2.5 years, I've discovered that my podcast has become an expose of corporate favors inside of the congressional bills. And so that's really where I'm going with it because it's been so consistent. And so now I'm still reading the bills. I'm now going into the Senate a bit too. Good thing for me is the Senate passes hardly anything ever. So
yeah, that's true. So Congress might pass a lot of these things and then they'll still get kind of dead in the water. We might not see them because then they get caught in the Senate.
Yeah. Well, it's a weird dynamic because of the leadership of these two branches. And so the House leadership has never changed since I've started doing this. Mm. So it's always been the same people. So they pass all kinds of stuff and they do it so quickly that a lot of times the people don't know what's in them.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's like there'll be a bill on the table and then there'll be a vote 2 days later and the bill's like 1500 pages mm-hmm. or, you know, it's like, how is anybody supposed to read that much without having, you know, making their entire office dedicate, which is what they should be doing. But
it's what they try to do, but yeah. It's happening so quickly that they actually can't. I've actually watched hearings. The last budget that they passed, it was doing all of the appropriations for the entire government in one bill, which is not how this is supposed to be done. It's supposed to be 12 separate bills that are carefully crafted, and they haven't done that since I've started reading the bills. Mm-hmm. So once again, they did the whole government in about a couple of days. And there were congressmen that were reading it in the hearing going, I just got this morning. How are we having this hearing right now? I don't even know what's in it. This is ridiculous. And then it was law just a couple of days later. And that's what they have to do to prevent a shutdown. And then so I took 3 weeks in January when it's already law to tear through it and read it and did an episode on it. Sure enough, there's all kinds of stuff in there that shouldn't be in there. Really big scandals like allowing bailouts of the big banks again and stuff that we had seen in standalone bills that died earlier in the Congress that they just slapped in there because it was such a massive bill and it became law. And another big one is they expanded how much rich people are allowed to give to political parties by like, it used to be a limit of $32,000 or so, which is more than I could ever pay.
Yeah.
But that was the limit. Now for a couple, for every election, they can give the political parties about $1 million.
Wow. And that's, all that really does is make it easier for them to not have to make, you know, a super PAC or something, to not have mm-hmm. to go through back channels because they're going to figure out how to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. But now it makes it easier for them to be able to be transparent about that. And this is something that I think is like an important thing to realize is when you talk about an appropriations bill, when you talk about, I mean, what that word really refers to is we're going to take all the money we have and appropriate it. We're going to put it in the places where it's supposed to go. This is our money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are our representatives. So this is the money that is literally taken from us through taxes, which is our responsibility as citizens.
Yeah.
And then it is appropriated by our representatives. We hire them. We elect them into office with the intention that they will make the right decisions about where to put the money that is necessary to run a government. And I think for the most part, I shouldn't say for the most part, for some part, they're trying to do what they can do. The problem is, lobbyism is so steeped in this culture that in order to, oh, but I want to get this thing passed so that it can help, you know, young school children in this part of my district. Well, then you got to get this aerospace thing glued onto it because it's the only way. And then eventually it's like so many deals and so much arm twisting that you end up with these, you know, multi-headed monsters, which mm-hmm. don't end up helping anybody.
Yeah. And the amount of good that they're trying to do, it seems like most of these people have their pet projects that allow them to go home and say, I'm doing good.
Yeah, because it's about their constituency back home. Well, that's what they argue.
They each have their pet project that lets them sleep at night, but they sell their souls to certain lobbyists. So, like, there's this one guy in Colorado. He's been great in a lot of ways. His name's Jared Polis. There's a clip that Joe Rogan plays all the time of him grilling the head of the DEA and being like, is marijuana as bad as heroin? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a great clip. So he'll do stuff like that, and we love him.
So I take it he's a Democrat.
Yes, he's a Democrat. although there are some Tea Party Republicans that understand the weed stuff. That's an interesting bunch.
Yeah, because it's that libertarianism that's kind of seeped into that weird right-wing group.
Libertarianism and a few regular people snuck in with the Tea Party wave. So it's an interesting dynamic that's going on in the Republican Party right now.
Yeah, like Rand Paul is definitely a Republican, and he's very pro-decriminalization, which is kind of interesting.
He's pro-decriminalization, but he's one of those that's actively trying to dismantle our government.
Yeah, there's
so there's this danger to that wing, you know, because you don't want to have no government. And that's honestly, like, they know how to destroy, but they don't know how to govern. But they're still trying to just deregulate everything. So they scare me. But like Jared Polis, he'll do things that we like that. Mm-hmm. But he made all of his money in charter schools. So he's pushing the privatization of public schools really hard. And that's just one example. There's so many people where it's like, oh, this person usually votes in my favor, but there's this issue where they don't. Like Jim Himes is a guy from Connecticut. He used to work on Wall Street, so he does the bank's bidding. So that bill that was literally written by Citigroup it died in the 113th Congress, but then got slipped in and became law with the budget. Jim Himes was behind that, but he has the D next to his name. And so people vote for him thinking that he's going to be this thing that you can't judge people by party. And that's a lesson that I've been learning so much, especially in the last 6 months or so, because there's crazy stuff going on and you just can't look at it by party. Like the fast tracking of trade agreements, that's been something that I have two episodes on it. It's been making me completely insane.
Really?
Yeah, because it's Congress ceding their ability to amend treaties to the executive branch. So basically the executive branch would negotiate all of them and then Congress would have to pass it up or down. But because they call these agreements, there's some kind of like legal mumbo jumbo that makes this legal, but because they call them agreements and they have this fast tracking legislation, it doesn't have to pass as a treaty, even though it's a treaty. Hmm. And a treaty is supposed to be passed with 2/3 of the Senate saying yes. But because of this fast track legislation, it would only have to be an up or down vote with the majority. So it makes it much easier to get this stuff written into law. And we have at least 4 international trade agreements that are being negotiated right now. We cannot see the text of any of them. We've seen 3 out of the 29 TPP chapters. That one's almost finished. I did not like what I saw inside of those. It's a really, really crazy process. And when you look at the Democrats versus Republicans, those two sides mean nothing.
Oh, no, no, no. Yeah. I mean, it definitely does seem like in some ways bipartisanship is, or I shouldn't even say partisanship, like partisan politics is alive and well. And the kind of the feud between the two camps, and that's a whole other conversation, is the fact that there are really only two camps, has a very meaningful outcome in some ways. In other ways, it really doesn't seem to matter. And I think the number one thing that, you know, almost anybody in my shoes, anybody with a strong progressive stance that that had kind of has like dug deep into what I think is the most sort of blatant undemocratic thing that we do in this country is the money in the politics. It's the campaign finance reform. Mm-hmm. It's as long as lobbyism can have the stranglehold that it has, nobody's immune.
Yeah.
And we're talking nobody. We're talking no branch of government, and we're talking no political party, but especially if we're talking about Congress, if we're talking about the legislative branch, people who pass laws, people write laws and then pass laws, Democrat or Republican, they're all taking money.
Taking massive amounts of money, money that I can't even imagine. And then when you look at what the money does, this is something that's been bothering me lately because I'm looking at, we're getting into a campaign season, and all that money does is buy television ads and pay for their dinners and pay for their travel and their open bar parties in their own honor. I mean, that's what fundraisers are.
Fundraisers are literally there so that they can continue to sway the rich people that are going to continue to give. It's at a certain point, it really is kind of snake eating its own tail. It's like this snowball of, I need to make money so I can continue to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
So little of it actually goes to, I think, the voter that's like the middle America swing voter at home. I mean, that is a portion of the targeted kind of attempts by these candidates, but a lot
that's
of it.
That's what the ads are for.
That's what the ads are for, but that's really all it is. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's the ads, but so much of it is like the dinners, like you said, the I'm going to go speak to the whatever group, and these are other groups of potential donors.
Mm-hmm. They're living the life and they're doing it on our dime because here we own, if you win a house in the or a seat in the House of Representatives, you're elected to do a job for us for 2 years, and they spend a lot of their time while on the job going to these fundraisers and traveling around the country and raising more money. So they're not doing their job. So what they should be doing is sitting inside the House of Representatives, reading these bills and debating these bills. Well, I'm watching this on C-SPAN every day and they're talking to an empty room. Yeah. You know, there's the same people that get up and talk every single time. And we do have some good people in Congress. They're vastly outnumbered by the ones who just aren't there. And so what's amazing to me is I keep seeing these suspension bills. And suspension bills are ones that are so overwhelmingly non-controversial that they pass with either a voice vote, which means there's no vote at all, or they pass with 2/3 of the House of Representatives.
Wait, a voice vote. Explain that to me. There's
a voice
vote.
They have a guy. Yeah. They have a guy who goes up there and basically says, does this pass? And if no one objects, it just passes.
It's like a default passing?
Yes.
That's so scary.
And that's been used to pass some really shady stuff.
Because even if it seems really non-controversial on the outset, there's all this pork in it.
Not even necessarily pork. Like one of the things I saw pass by voice vote was the gutting of the Stock Act. So I don't know if you remember this. It was 2012, I believe, over the summer. one of those shows, like 60 Minutes, I think, ran something about John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi making money off of their insider knowledge that they get from Congress. So they would go and bet on the stock market and they would make money. And I guess everyone in Congress is doing this. So
yeah, because they're privy to a lot of information.
They get a lot of information. And then if you have that information that the public doesn't have, well, obviously you can buy that company that you know is going to explode and you make a ton of money.
Yeah. By the way, that's called insider trading. It's very against the law.
It's very against
but
the law.
But they do it anyway.
Exactly.
Because it's hard to prove.
Exactly. So this 60 Minutes thing comes out. And so they passed the Stock Act, which was really fluffy to begin with. It wasn't really making anything illegal. But the thing that had the most teeth is that we were supposed to have a website that was publicly searchable, not password protected, that showed us the finances of our elected representatives and their staff. And so this passes into law with photographers and cameras and a signing ceremony and all of that. They made a big deal over it. A year later, after everyone was gone for the day, and there's a very predictable pattern on Fridays that you just kind of know that when this person talks, the day is over. There's no more votes.
Gotcha.
So the person that is Eric Cantor. And after he had talked for like 25 minutes, so there's no one in the room, he quickly passes a bill that guts that whole website, just repeals the whole thing, makes it go away. And he passed it through an empty room. So it was basically like, I want to introduce this bill. Does it pass? No one was there to say no. And so it did. And this happened in the Senate, and Obama signed it into law on April 15th of 2013. Maybe that would have hit the news if the Boston Marathon bombings hadn't been that day.
Yeah. Why do you think Obama signed it into law?
Well, because that was the day that people's staffers were supposed to turn in their financial information, and they had never actually planned to make them do that to begin with. So if it hadn't been signed into law, because it was April 15th, it was tax day. If it hadn't been signed into law that day, then the staffers would have technically been breaking the law by not turning in their financial information.
But they never requested it.
Yeah, they never had. Yeah. They were never told that they had to do this. And I guess it was the plan the whole time. I don't really know what happened behind the scenes. But Harry Reid introduced it on a Thursday. Eric Cantor introduced it on a Friday. And it was law by Monday.
Doesn't this strike you when you really start to get into the nitty gritty, because we hear about these stories, right? But you're somebody who is kind of living the life of literally saying, I'm going to commit to reading every single page. I'm going to commit to watching C-SPAN all of the time. And I'm going to try and inform myself. I'm not steeped in politics. Like, I don't work on the Hill. I didn't grow up in this lifestyle. It's something that I'm just interested in. And I want to try and do it as a normal everyday citizen. The more that you learn, doesn't it start to feel like sort of the argument that a lot of academic types will make about standardized testing, where after a while, it's less about testing what you know, and it's more about just learning how to beat the test. Like, it seems like so much of the way that floor votes happen in the legislative branch has less to do with the content of the bills. It has less to do with how informed the staff is. It has less to do with what's obviously the last thing I would say is what's best for the people as a representative democracy. And it has so much more to do with like playing these weird games. It's like a pinball machine. Yeah. Oh, you got to make sure you show up on the floor because they're going to try and pass something out from under you. Like, I mean, my knowledge about this comes from literally like reading The Nation and watching Veep.
Yeah.
But I've talked to some people that worked on Capitol Hill who were like, if I were to pick a TV show that most represents what our lives were like, it's not like The West Wing. It's much more like Veep.
Yeah.
That it's a lot of kind of creative games to figure out how to get things sort of, you know, under the radar and how to package things in a way to convince people to pass them and trying to just convince people to show up to votes before it's, you know, they break for vacation. It's it's like herding cats. It's embarrassing.
It's awful. It's tough to sit there and watch. But I have a sick sense of humor. So I guess I can kind of like laugh at it. But we just had the Patriot Act expire, or the Patriot Act, yeah, expire is the word I'm looking for. And they wanted to go on vacation. So because they were fast-tracking that fast-track legislation that I talked about before, there's no deadline on that. They just want to do it before next year because that's the election year. So they want to get it done so that we'll forget about it by the time we vote. It's so gross. So they did that instead of working on the Patriot Act reauthorization. So it expired for 2 days, and then they passed this USA Freedom Act, which I read for my last episode, which is an absolute nightmare. It's a horrible bill.
Is it worse than the Patriot Act?
It's just pretty as bad. Yeah. The thing that makes me the most angry about it is a passage that I saw in there that no one's talking about. Mm-hmm. That basically says that if the government stops doing whatever illegal thing they were doing to collect our information, then that information can be used in court. So everything that they were collecting for the last 15 years illegally, which has been ruled illegal by the second highest court in this country, and then forever going forward, as long as the government says, oh, yeah, that was illegal, but we fixed it, then they can use in that stuff in court against us. Yeah. And I understand why they did it, because they've been locking people up on drug charges with the information they've gotten from the NSA for years. And so, yeah, people would have very legitimate rights to appeal those cases, but that's what happens. You know, that's why you don't allow the government to break the law. And so now there's this thing in the USA Freedom Act that I am convinced is going to come back and bite us in the ass and allow us to be locked up with illegally obtained information forever. And I haven't heard a single person other than myself say anything about it. And that's the problem that I'm seeing with the media, is that I have a list in my last episodes of the five most I don't know if they're trustworthy, but New York Times, Associated Press, Forbes, Guardian. I mean, we look at
these. Yeah, we think of them as the arbiters of what matters.
Yeah. And they're all saying that this bill ends data collection. And no, it doesn't. So if you just read the headlines, which is what most people do, if they read it all, you think that all that stuff that Edward Snowden told us about is done. And that could not be further from the truth. And the USA Freedom Act, it brought the Patriot Act back from the dead, or at least that one. There were only a couple provisions that expired. Mm-hmm. But by passing the USA Freedom Act, you didn't end anything. Because it had expired, you brought them back. And this is not what the media is saying. This is one of these Alice in Wonderland experiences for me, where I'm just reading the opposite of what I saw with my own eyes. And so one of the things that I do for my podcast is I take a ton of time when I'm reading the bills to make my show notes, so that not only will you look up my links. So it's like that passage I told you about. Mm-hmm. You can go to my show notes, click on that link, and it's going to take you to the exact portion of that bill. So I don't just link to the entire bill. I'll show you that exact thing to be like,
read it
yourself.
Tell me
if I'm wrong. You know, I don't know if I'm right, but here you go. Here's everything you need. And one of the reasons I do this is, hey, you're making tons of money at the New York Times. Good for you. Use this and do some journalism. I'm doing the work for you. And they either don't know that this exists, which is totally possible because my show's not that big, but it's just not happening.
The sad thing is just like our elected officials probably haven't read that bill all the way through. I sincerely doubt that these journalists who are covering it have read that bill.
There's no chance.
Somebody is bell ringing, like unless you were on a desk there and you were like, wait, guys, let's look at this. We need to make sure that, you know, this is the headline here. If nobody ever points it out, it's just a sleeping giant, you know? And that's I think one of the scariest things about how some of these bills do become law and how some of these kinds of deals are made is that not only is the general public not really privy to it, the guy next door, the guy down the hall, you know, on the Hill might not be privy to it. Because so many things are intentionally shielded from view. So many things are written in such a way to be overcomplicated. Yep. Or to include so many additional and kind of unnecessary provisions so that you can't really find that needle in the haystack. And then even then, let's be honest, like there is some interplay between the people in these positions of power and the media here.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we do have a free press. I'm not, you know, a conspiracy theorist, and I'm not claiming that an incredible investigative reporter at Frontline or at the New York Times, when they catch wind of things that matter, aren't going to write about them. But at the same time, unless somebody figures that out on their own, sometimes kind of the headline is dictated by the person who wants to dictate it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, there's that documentary about Cenk Uygur when he was in MSNBC, when he was told, we are the establishment, you know, and so he had to leave. And I remember Rachel Maddow is actually one of the original podcasters, and I listened to her before she was ever on TV. And when she was offered that job at the time, she was one of the people that was talking the most about what was going on in the war. Well, to get an offer from MSNBC, that meant that she was working for NBC, which is owned by General Motors, which is, or General Electric, which is a defense contractor. So she went into this and discussed it with her audience and said, when I go to MSNBC, I can have stories that go out to so many more people, but I will be muzzled. I know I will be muzzled.
That's a risk benefit for these people. It's like, is it more important that, let's say, the 90% of the content that I want to get out there gets out there to a much broader audience? Or is it important that I stay here and I stay small and I stay independent, but I can say that extra 10% of the stuff that I'm not allowed to say when I, because we don't have, we do have a free press in this country, but we still have legacy and establishment media outlets that control most of the dialogue. So even though anybody can get on a mic and can say what they want to say and they can't get arrested for it, which is incredible, and I'm so glad that we have that opportunity, if you want to go on television on one of the major news networks, you follow the chain. Like, there's only like five companies that own every single media outlet, unless they're independent.
Yeah. As long as we're talking about TV. And that's the thing, you're right, that we can do this now. We can have this conversation at our kitchen table and talk to thousands of people, but this is new.
And it's only thousands of people. Like, it, as popular and as, you know, I'm not Joe Rogan, and I don't have hundreds of thousands of listens per episode, you know? Yeah. And even though in some ways cable news is really dying and it's kind of embarrassing, like even some of the shows that I've worked on before get less viewership than my listenership on the podcast, which is insane to me. There is still something to be said about having a primetime slot on a network television show. Like, you're going to reach more people.
Yeah, but I feel like that's going to change.
Yeah,
I think
it is.
That's what I have a lot of hope about, because I know very few people my own age that watch cable news ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're getting their news from a lot of different places, but most of it is coming from the internet, whether it's reading on the internet, or I think podcasting is going to get much bigger as soon as it's easily available in cars and on Android devices. Those are two big barriers for us right now. But in the same way that talk radio was huge for our parents in the 1990s, this is the next age of,
I agree,
of talk radio, and this is how we're going to do it. So it's going to open up more voices like ours to get out there. But right now, there really is this, especially with the baby boomers, who unfortunately are the ones who are voting. We're not voting, and our grandparents vote even more than they do. So this stuff, like we were saying before, all the money goes to ads, and it goes to the radio, and it goes to TV. Well, as long as those are the people that are voting, this stuff is still going to work. It's not working on our generation, but we're not showing up.
Mm-hmm.
So this stat just blows me away. But in California, between the ages of 18 and 22 in the last election, so the college age people, 8% voter turnout.
Yeah, I could see that.
But it's all eligible
low.
To vote.
Yeah.
They're all pissed off. You know, like, we have the protests up in Berkeley. The whole school's out there throwing rocks through windows talking about revolution, but they don't show up to vote. So as long as we have this barrier, we're not going to change anything.
And part of the reason that we see the very low voter turnout among millennials, I think it's less because, you know, people like to say that it's because millennials are lazy, which
I don't think
it's all clicktivism and it's lazy activism and all of that. I mean, it's a very common headline. But I think what you end up seeing quite often is a new generation of young people who are more informed than their forebears by, I would say, more varied outlets. So they're able to read counterculture news. They're able to get information that maybe their parents weren't able to get because they're not stuck just looking at establishment news. And because of that, they learn the kinds of things that especially your podcast informs people of, and they become so like disheartened.
Yeah.
And they start to feel like, no matter what I do, I'm not going to make a difference. And that is the motivation that keeps them from the polls.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that famous South Park episode where it was, I can't even remember. It was like, do I vote for the douchebag or the shit sandwich or whatever, whatever the two were. And they're like, I don't, is it really matter? And that's the part of me that's, I don't know, that gets really frustrated and gets really depressed about. And I can tie this back to some of the science work that I do, is that you're always walking this fine line between being so cynical that you throw your hands up and being so fired up and so excited for the potential of change that you want to motivate people to get more involved. You know, when it comes to science literacy in this country, I think we're in the same boat.
Yeah,
it's like,
I agree.
You know, as we are when it comes to distrust of politicians, but especially young people. I think it's rare that you would see cynicism in our parents and our grandparents the way that you see cynicism in 18 to 22 year olds. Or they're like, why would I vote?
I mean, look, these are the kids that were actual kids when 9/11 happened. Yeah. I was an adult. I was 18. So I was able to kind of process that. And I lived through the happy 90s where mm-hmm. the biggest problem was a blowjob. You know, it was like, it was a completely different time. These kids, their whole life has been serious and they've seen our country doing crazy things. And now they just don't know what to do about it. And one of the things that I hear a lot, because after the election, I got a little angry and I went a little off. And so I received a lot of feedback. And I heard over and over and over again, these kids telling me that I don't want to participate in a corrupt system.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they
that's a common sentiment.
Yeah. They think that sitting out is some kind of thing to be proud of. And they're wrong.
It's like a boycott or something. Like somehow it's actually going to change anything. But as and I think that also comes from a bit of intellectual immaturity. I mean, I think if you look at anybody who's got like a revolutionary spirit, when they're young, they're anarchists, you know, when they're young, they're throwing rocks and they're saying down with the system. And then as they get a little bit older, they start to realize the only way to change the system is from inside.
Yeah.
But then they get even older and they get disillusioned again.
Well, I think we've also been taught, and there's a term that's just used all the time where we just blame the government for everything.
Yeah.
And we don't bother to look at which part of the government is doing everything. So when we talk about NSA spying, it's always, well, the government is bad. It's like, no, 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 no. The executive branch is out of control. The military in particular is out of control because the NSA is part of the military.
Yeah.
And we spend half of our tax money on the military. Actually, it's more than half, but
it's a lot. It's we have a massive lot. Military budget.
Yeah.
And we also
And that's who's doing it. It's not the government. So they get mad at the government and they don't see the government as the tool that we collectively have to shape our society. It's never been talked to them in that manner.
Yeah.
And so until we kind of change our thoughts on what the government is, that it's not this thing that controls us, it's the thing we use to decide what we want to be as a society.
And it's not even really a thing, it's a who. And that's mm-hmm. something that we forget too. These are actors. These are active participants. These are people that we put in power because there are employees. And when you ask most people, what about it? What are you so upset about? Most people fully agree with the Constitution.
Yes.
Most people feel very strongly that kind of the pillars of our government, the way that we have a divided government, the checks and balances that exist in our government, they fully agree with. It's the people and the decisions that they make and the choices that they make. And again, the money in politics, which I can't stress enough, does seem to be underpinning a lot of these problems.
I think it's the linchpin of all of them.
It really is. I think that if that were to change, which unfortunately it's the hardest thing to change, it's so entrenched. It's mm-hmm. because everyone benefits from it. It's like, how do you change a system where all of the people in the system want it to stay the same way?
Yeah. I actually think that there's two ways. And I think Cenk is onto one of them. So mm-hmm. the Wolfpack idea of going to all the different states to pass a constitutional amendment to go around Congress, because you're not going to get Congress to pass something that takes away their money. That's insane.
It's also insane that Congress actually has control over things like congressional pay raises and like their own health insurance. Like Congress shouldn't, and that shouldn't be, it's just crazy.
$174,000 minimum wage for people in Congress.
It's just,
like it just tells you everything right there.
Yeah, well, it's just kind of like letting the kindergartners choose what they're going to have for lunch every day. Like you can't do that. Like somebody has to make a decision from the outside. Anyway. Yeah.
Okay. So that's one thing that's brilliant about our system. And so we can go through the states. I like that idea. I support that idea. But then the other thing we can do is we can use our votes to vote for the person who doesn't collect the money.
Yeah.
So like Bernie Sanders right now, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are the two, you know, big Democrats that are running for president. Bernie Sanders has collected less money total than Hillary Clinton has collected just from the financial industry.
Mm-hmm.
That tells me just about everything I need to know. And I feel like if our generation can find a way to use this magical tool called the internet to get ourselves on the ballot, because I'm going to do an episode where I list all 50 states from the easiest to get your name to the hardest. Unfortunately, California is second to last on that list. It's very hard.
Interesting.
But there are places like Oklahoma, 25 signatures, you're in.
Yeah.
Your name is on the ballot. And then if you can use the internet and go and shake hands, do it the old-fashioned way, collect no money, run on I don't take the money. And then you get those people in there, they're not going to be corrupted because they didn't take the cash.
Yeah.
So there is a way to run.
I think the fear is, though, is this idea of are politicians intrinsically, is there something intrinsic to wanting to go into politics that makes you a bit megalomaniacal, makes you a bit power hungry, and definitely makes you interested in these kinds of decisions and these kinds of trades? Or does ultimate power ultimately corrupt? And I think that that's something that I would love to get your take on in just a couple minutes, because I'm going to take a quick break and thank the sponsor of today's episode. We'll be right back with Jen Briney. I want to thank NatureBox for supporting this episode of Talk Nerdy. Visit www.naturebox.com/talknerdy for a free trial and start snacking smarter. Now, guys, I've said it before, I'll say it again. We get hungry. We get hungry in between meals, before meals, after meals, even during our meals sometimes, especially if you're doing what I'm doing lately and really cutting calories and eating a high-protein diet. And when you're hungry, you want something to munch on. But don't you want to make your snacking count? Yummy treats from NatureBox are the way to do it. They're totally satisfying, but they don't make you feel guilty afterward. With NatureBox, you can choose from over 100 healthy, tasty options. And the best part is they're delivered right to your door. You don't have to go out. You don't have to shop for them. They'll send them right to you. And even better, all of their snacks are made with no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, and 0 grams of trans fat, and also 0 high fructose corn syrup. And it's not just that they're healthy. I mean, you wouldn't even know that they're healthy because they're just so tasty. There are treats like fancy dried figs, PB&J granola, and even white cheddar caramel popcorn. Yum. And my all-time favorite, I love to talk about it. I mention it every time NatureBox sponsors an episode. My favorite are strawberry carrot fruit chews. They're so delicious. They're so tasty. And they kind of take me back to my childhood a little bit. All right, guys, what are you waiting for? Go to naturebox.com/talknerdy right now for a completely free trial of amazing snacks that will be delivered right to your door. You'll satisfy your craving in a healthy, natural way, and you'll support the podcast at the same time. Doesn't get any better than that. So don't wait. Go right now to naturebox.com/talknerdy. That's naturebox.com/talknerdy. We're back with Jen Briney, host of the Congressional... It's not the, though. It's just host of Congressional Dish.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah. Host of the Congressional Dish podcast. And we are talking about, God, so many things. But really, we do keep coming back to this theme of campaign finance reform. We come back to this theme of money in politics. And I think that there is kind of this, you know, this ethics quandary that a lot of people would ask. More of a thought experiment, but that has real implications, which is... Do the people who go into government generally start going into it with these noble ideas and ultimately keep them with them throughout their careers? Because I don't think it's as easy as saying money corrupts, these people are nefarious, they have no interest in ever doing anything that's right. Like, that's obviously not true. A lot of these people who take a lot of corporate money are still trying to make decisions that, in their weird, twisted view, are best for the public.
Yeah.
And also best for the corporate interests.
One pattern that I've noticed is that we are electing business people who go there and openly represent business, mm-hmm. which means that they're representing the stock market. So a lot of the things that we're seeing is that we're seeing bills written for multinational corporations. And what's good for them is good for the stock market. So we're electing very wealthy people. Most of them are millionaires now. We're electing people who make their money on the stock market. And that's the world they live in. So mm-hmm. what's good for the stock market is good for them and for everyone they know. And so I think that's how they justify what they do, because they see it as you're growing the economy, you're creating more jobs because these companies are getting bigger and profits are great, but they don't live like we do. You know, they don't run into us in the supermarket because they obviously have people that go and get stuff for them. I mean, it's a totally different world. We're not voting for people that are like us. So no, I don't think that there's a single bad person. I don't think there's evil in Congress. I think that they have different priorities, and I think that firing them is the most appropriate thing to do. I wish them well, but they're not representing me. They're representing the corporate world that they came from and that they run on. They tell you right up front who they are. But
so why do you think that it is that there is still a percentage of the American population who buys in hook, line, and sinker, who kind of agrees that corporations are people who, you know, are comfortable with corporations being represented the same way that we are, and who really truly believe that like you said, what's good for the stock market actually is good for the economy.
The problem with that is I don't know those people.
There's a lot of them.
In my day-to-day life, I just don't seem to meet them. Or maybe they're afraid to tell me. That could be a part of it, too.
I think part of it is that they don't live here. I think that a big part of when we think of, quote, flyover states, we think of red state voters. And we, elitist coastal voters, can very easily snicker in the background and say things like, you know, laugh at the people in the picture of get your that are holding up a protest sign that says get your government hands off my Medicare.
Yeah.
And laugh about people who say that trickle down economics is a real thing and that these are job creators and we need to put them in office. But the truth of the matter is that
they believe it.
A lot of people vote against their own interests.
And I think the main reason because of that is the television media in particular.
You think so?
It's because of
like right-wing talk radio. It's because of conservative websites.
My husband and I, we did a 3-month road trip across the United States because I wanted to experience these flyover states and spend some time there and meet these people. And so we did. And when we were driving through Kansas, there were two radio stations. One was Rush and one was Jesus. Mm-hmm. So if that's all you have when you're in your car and then you go home and you watch the TV and that is your outlet to the rest of the world, you think that this stuff makes sense. And then when you listen to these arguments, Ann Coulter is a master of this. She'll say something that doesn't actually make sense, but make it sound like it does.
Sure.
You know, like there's this whole twisty logic that goes on and these people are trying to be informed. They're turning on the news. And this is what they think is right. This is what they're learning. This is how they get their education. So by being allowed to label pure opinion as news and have that be the only stuff that people have access to, they think it's reality.
But what do you do about that? I mean, I say a lot on the show that I quote, it's actually a very complicated quote, so I'm not going to bring it up. But this idea of like, I think that the people who have ultimate control over the message when it comes to the news media feel very strongly, or at least they push the opinion out there, that they're just giving the people what they want. I take massive issue with that because I think that we have just the illusion of choice. If you only have these two radio stations, of course you're going to want to listen to one of them. It's the only thing you have. And you're going to find these nuanced differences between the Rush show and the Jesus show, but they're still both kind of weird and conservative and have very similar viewpoints.
Well, and they both have the idea that it is good to believe things because you believe them.
Sure.
And needing no facts.
Yeah, yeah. And that being said, I think part of the issue is that ultimately it does become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's easy to stand outside of it and say, but if there were more options, these good-natured people who are very bright, who are trying to find answers to their questions, would seek out evidence and would seek out facts and would seek out truth. But after you've been inundated your entire life with a certain political persuasion, with a certain viewpoint, with a certain set of values and beliefs, I'm not sure that it's true that if there were more options there that, you know, a Fox News, a dyed-in-the-wool Fox News viewer would want to watch, not Fox News. So what do you do about that?
How do we let them go?
And this is, honestly, most of the country. These people...
I think that's not true. Because
really?
When you look at these polls, even going back into the Bush years, we have about 20 to 25%, which is too much, but it's consistent that it's in between 20 and 25% of people that are really believing this stuff. Mm-hmm. We can deal with that because that means that 75% of us don't.
Yet Bush still got elected. So he still had the majority.
Yeah, he did. And I think a lot of that has to do with the team mentality, the way that we're dealing with politics, that it's, I'm a Republican, my parents are Republican, I vote Republican, I vote straight ticket, that's my team.
Gotcha. Because there are moderate Republicans who have spoken out, you know, time and time again that they don't even recognize their party anymore. And that it's really sad that anybody who, and of course I'm devil's advocating really hardcore on this podcast, but I think it's because I am liberal and it's easy for me to just be like, oh, I'm right and they're wrong and you know, and it's like whatever. But I try to put myself in the shoes of my father, for example, who is a Texas Latter-day Saint. He's Mormon and he's conservative, but he's a very reasonable man. He's a very smart man. He's an engineer. He, you know, his wife is a biology teacher. They are pro education. They're, you know, respected in their community. He's not a bigot. Mm-hmm. He's not, you know, a redneck. And I want to understand what it means to be a reasonable Republican. And I want to understand. I also want to, I wish that the moderate right wing actually had options anymore, because yeah. their entire party's been co-opted by these insane Tea Party people who are so far to the right that they've moved the middle. Like, the middle is more conservative than it used to be. And this is something that we don't think about enough. When we look decades ago at what a moderate viewpoint was for this country, I will always be left of that goalpost. I know it. I will always be on the super progressive liberal end. I will never be content with how things are. But the conservative end was opposite where I was. And then there was this middle. And the conservative end has gone so far to the right that the moderates are now more conservative than they've ever been. And that scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, I hate all of those terms.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, yeah. I'd love your take on this.
I feel like even discussing where people fall on the label spectrum, it only serves to divide us, because I used to be a Republican. I was mm-hmm. one of these people, because both my parents were Republicans. They are Republicans. My mom has one of those Rush Limbaugh mugs that says ditto on it. Oh God. Like, that's how far yeah. this has gone in my family. So I was raised Republican. I voted for George W. Bush. I was one of these people, and it was all because of the team. Mm-hmm. And I was required to say I was conservative. I didn't know what that meant. You know, and I still don't know what that means, because you can debate all day long, but then when you look at the actual contents of the bills, you can take a conservative and a progressive, sit them right next to each other, and talk about fast track authority for trade agreements, and they're agreeing with each other.
Yeah, that's true.
So when we look at these frankly bullshit labels, I don't think it does us any favors, and it takes great conversations like the one we're having, and we end up discussing the label instead of discussing the bill.
And I think what's really scary is that I personally do think that even if the labels didn't exist, even if I didn't say progressive, and I
don't mean to jump down your throat about
no,
that.
No, I agree. And I fully agree with you, hook, line, and sinker, about the idea of a Democrat versus a Republican, because there's no fucking difference. Like, I really don't see much of a difference. I'm definitely not a Democrat. I'm like way left of the Democratic Party. But when I talk about calling oneself, or not even calling oneself, but having these intrinsic values that are either progressive or conservative, I think that whether the label existed or not, if you polled people, there would be core values that really do polarize. I think part of the problem is that our politicians, when they're campaigning and they're trying to get their votes, that's not what they're campaigning on. They're not campaigning on core values. They're campaigning on third rail issues that continue to divide, like mm-hmm. like bigotry towards gay people, you know, like
abortion,
like sanctity of marriage, abortion, things yeah. that are like have very little to do with what we think of as traditional party values, you know, like do we favor government? Do we favor independence? Do we want you know, do we want government assistance for people who amongst us are very weak and needed? Or do we want a kind of cutthroat, you know, help yourself, no safety net sort of an economy built up? And these are things that really have traditionally throughout history mm-hmm. divided the parties.
Yeah.
We don't talk about that shit anymore.
We don't talk about that anymore. And I think it's because, like we said before, six companies are controlling the whole country. So they're controlling the conversation in they like having no government. So it's just, it's a byproduct of when you deregulate the whole government, then you get people who don't want to give out food stamps either. But hey, the banks don't have to follow any rules, and that's profitable. So, you know, screw them. So they do this anti-government message, and the stuff that we care about, it gets hurt in the shuffle, because we've divided ourselves into believing that these teams represent us, when they actually get there, they don't.
So they represent financial interests, and that's the really
interesting
thing.
And the businesses that pay them. But if we were to sit at the table and have very interesting conversations with people that identify or label themselves as conservative or progressive, it's quite easy to come to consensus on these issues.
Yeah, I think we could get to the bottom of the things that really do divide us, and we could make it very clear what everybody agrees on.
Yeah,
like everybody is afraid of, you know, these privacy issues. Like, mm-hmm. it's not a right wing or a left wing thing for people to not want to have their text messages read by the NSA.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these kinds of bipartisan issues. I think something that's very compelling and very, I guess, telling is that when you do follow the money by these corporate interests, and let's pick something really nefarious, like a big oil company or something, where it's, as a progressive, you're like, oh, they're evil.
One of my favorite villains.
Yeah, exactly. It's like so easy to demonize the oil industry. So let's say we pick a big ExxonMobil or something, and we look, honey, you better believe they're paying off both Democrats and Republicans. It's not even that like certain companies are lobbying certain political parties. They're playing both sides of the aisle. Yeah. They're very smart. They know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. And it shows up right there in the votes. When I read these, the 113th Congress was very pro-fossil fuel, out in the open, passing these bills all the time. They've really cooled it in the 114th, which is
interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah, that is cool. Why do you think that is?
I don't know.
I mean, is it that they're like growing balls? Or you think that there's a tidal shift in the actual culture where people are starting to go like, guys, it's so obvious. We can't be doing this anymore. Yeah. Climate change is pissing everybody off.
I think that's becoming a part of it. And I also think that the divestment movement is actually starting to freak out everyone with lots of money.
Interesting. So yeah. explain that a little bit more.
So this was an idea that was started. I think it was the started. I know that they pushed it the hardest by 350.org. Mm-hmm. And 350 is the amount of parts per million of carbon dioxide we're allowed to safely have in the air before we, you know, burst into flames.
Not exactly what happened, but close.
But yeah, I guess I'm talking to a scientist, so I shouldn't talk like that. But we're at 400 parts per million.
Yeah.
So what they started to do was appeal to colleges and these big money institutions and say, stop investing your money in fossil fuels. So they got their students to push all of these different colleges to take their money out of fossil fuels. And it's working. There are whole cities now that have taken their money out of fossil fuels. And there's lots of colleges that are doing it. And so I think because that's starting to work, Wall Street is starting to go, okay.
Like it's falling out of fashion. Yeah.
Yeah. Fossil fuels maybe isn't the future. And there are people like me and you who are probably pissed off that we're spending half of our tax money protecting the fossil fuel resources so that we can basically steal them. And it's not even we. ExxonMobil is not an American company. They're a multinational. They know no borders.
Most of these companies are multinational. And that's a funny thing, because as you describe this process of how divestment is happening, that's what lobbying is supposed to be. Lobbying is supposed to be having an idea that you think is better for people for whatever reason, and then going and lobbying about it, talking to your representatives, talking to academic institutions, talking to people on Wall Street and saying, guys, here's the information. I'm going to lobby you. I'm going to plead with you to vote in this direction, to make decisions in this direction, because X, Y, Z. Lobbying should not also be connected to, and then also hear some payola for it.
Yeah.
That's the big problem. Because if it was really about people going, and there's a dance. There are laws in place that prevent certain people from being able to do certain things. And they get around it. They go, oh, well, I never actually gave him money. I just took him on this beautiful trip to Tahiti, and you know, he didn't have to pay anything, but I never put money in his hand. And that's what lobbying has become.
Yeah.
Convincing people to make decisions based on how much of a favor they owe you, instead of convincing them to make decisions based on, I don't know, the available evidence.
Yeah. Well, and the lobbyists, we have to remember, are also these people's friends, because we have this it's such a cliche, the revolving door, but it is true, because Eric Cantor was the second highest ranked person in the House of Representatives before he lost his primary election last year. So, of course, he resigned right away, because why would he finish serving the public even though he was elected?
It's so embarrassing.
Yeah. Like that. Why would I do that? So he went immediately to work for the banks.
They all do.
Yeah. He's a lobbyist for the banks. That's what he's doing. So he's going back to the people that he worked next to 6 months ago and saying, hey, put this in this bill, you know, that I've got. I mean, I don't actually know how it works. I'm not there. So I can't.
But like, I've got friends. I've got all this influence. I know how to write a bill. I can help you write it. I mean, there are form letter bills, right? There are things where like, ALEC, exactly, where these companies will actually write a bill for a congressperson and then hand it over to them. And then they'll like change a couple words and submit it. And you can trace back the evidence, and you can find these form letter bills where
they're
you're like,
online.
It's so crazy.
It's so easy.
And then it revolves in the other way too. You'll see a new administration come in and they'll hire up their new cabinet, and it'll be like, oh, you're hiring a guy who's in charge of, you know, regulating the oil industry, who used to be an oil executive. That feels like a conflict of fucking interest.
It does.
And somehow
the U.S. Trade Representative, the one who's negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership and our international trade deal with Europe, and now we have one with Israel and Turkey. I mean, we're really doing this in the entire world. He came from Citigroup.
Yeah.
That's who he was.
And it's so common at this point that when you go, that like when you say that, I go, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't go like, are you fucking serious? We need to do something about it. And like, why? Why are we not acting like that? Why have we become so complacent? It's so common. It's so run of the mill that you were just describing this millennial disengagement, this I don't want to participate in a corrupt system. It feels like there's literally nothing to be done about it because it's so far-reaching.
That's why I'm so excited, because now that I know the numbers for voter turnout and how few of us have shown up, if we can tell people and convince people, and that's the thing, the spreading of an idea, especially in America, it can happen like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't really have that much hope for 2016 because it's a presidential election. There's just so much crap going on. And everybody shows up to vote for that one.
Do you at least hope that a Democrat is going to be in office?
Oh, I don't give a shit. Hillary Clinton is horrible. She's horrible. Her whole time as Secretary of State, she was the one negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And she's refusing to say whether or not she supports it. I have a sound clip of her fighting for it when she was Secretary of State while she was creating it. So she's so full of shit and she takes so much money. She's horrible.
And
so
do you think that like
her and like a Rand Paul,
it's really six and one, half a dozen the other to you?
Don't you think though that
at least
Bernie Sanders a lot?
I like Bernie Sanders too. I mean, I like Elizabeth Warren, like personally.
She's not running.
I know she's not running, which makes me very sad.
It doesn't
and
make
she's
me
getting
sad
older.
At all, because Bernie Sanders is legit.
And she might have split the ticket if she did that. But I think I do still feel like I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to win. I think Hillary's going to get the primary. And I think that if it really were between a Hillary and a Rand Paul, and God, I would hope for Rand Paul instead of like the Bush fucking reject, or who is the one guy running? You know, the Indian guy, Bobby Jindal. Oh God.
No.
God, there's so many bad candidates on the right right now.
But that's what makes me crazy, is like we're focusing so much on the presidential election as a country, not just you and I, but like the whole country.
We always have. Yeah, the executive branch has always carried all of the weight. We've always, because they're the rock stars of government.
Exactly. And we have very little control over the ones who are anointed to actually get that far. It's very hard for someone like a Bernie Sanders who has actual principles to get that far. But
and
our branch of government is Congress.
Exactly. And that's the thing. Even if Bernie Sanders gets elected, he's going to be impotent if we elect a hardcore right-wing Congress.
Exactly. And that's what made me so upset about working as hard as I did for 2 years and then watching the Republicans take over the Senate, because they shut down our government because we dared to pass Obamacare, which just puts restrictions on private insurers.
Yeah, and Obamacare is actually like a big blowjob to the insurance company.
It really is. I read it during the shutdown, so I have a whole episode on it. It's not good, but it's better than what we had before, which
I have health insurance now, so that's good.
Me too, and I don't work for a corporation.
Exactly.
So, which I had to in order to get it when I graduated college, which I burned 3 years of my life because I just needed health insurance.
Isn't
working
that sad
for a company
that people take jobs to get health insurance? Oh my God, there's so many fucking
example.
Alleys. We could. What's the word I'm looking for? There's so many
Rabbit holes.
Rabbit holes. I kept wanting to say rat hole. Anyway,
but I just want to end this on like a really positive note, because I'm super hopeful, because so few young people have voted, that if we take over a midterm election and just show up and hopefully put some of our own names on the ballot so you have something to vote for, because that is the other half of this. If you're voting between two garbage candidates, you're just going to get garbage.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can actually vote in one midterm election and take over Congress, we can change everything in a day. And it's beautiful. And it's really easy with the House of Representatives, because the House of Representatives controls the money and we can fire them every 2 years. So if we screw up 2 years later, you can fire them. Every one of them is up for re-election every 2 years. And I know very few millennials that even know that fact.
And a massive quantity of them run unopposed.
I know. How crazy is that?
The number one predictor of getting elected if you're in Congress is that you've been elected before. Like, it's that you're already in office.
It's true. And that is just a beautiful opportunity to use the really brilliant system that was designed for us in the beginning of our country, this is exactly the type of moment that our system was designed for. All we need is to get people our age, which I think we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. If we can just spread this idea of vote in the midterms, vote for Congress, like stop paying so much attention to the presidential election, which is tough because it's all the media wants to focus on. It's the lowest hanging fruit. But if we pay attention to our own congressperson and vote especially for the House of Representatives, we control the money. Yeah. So, and that's the thing, like when you were saying before, is that do people that are already deranged want to go into the House of Representatives? Maybe I'm deranged. I do read bills for a living, but I would love to at least put my name on the ballot.
And the cool thing is that's actually possible at the level of the legislative branch. Like mm-hmm. when we talk about the presidential election, these people have been in a pipeline for their whole lives. Like they are breeding quality, you know, executive candidates. And Obama was a totally different kind of thing. He was the rock star. He also disillusioned a lot of people. So there's that. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Congress, I mean, do you know who your elected officials are? You do. But like, do a lot of people who are listening know who is in charge of the 100 whatever district in their state? And, you know, Colbert did that whole like know your congressperson or better know a district thing where he would pick a small district and talk to whoever represents that. And it just feels like, God, there's so many run unopposed, like we said, and so many really are just kind of like small town people who got involved in government. Like you can make a difference at this level. Yeah. It actually is more local than we think. And it is the level that has the most control.
And it was designed that way. We were always supposed to be very much in control of the House of Representatives, and that we've taken our eye off the ball. And that's the beautiful thing, though. All it takes is getting people to register to vote and actually go. And I know it's like it's such a simple solution, so people go, oh, that won't make a difference. No, it's the only thing that does. Because if you look at the people that showed up in November, they changed the Senate.
Yeah.
That's huge. That's real power shifts that took place in our country. And we're getting the repercussions of it right now with this trade agreement stuff.
And we don't even have to come out it like with 100%. Our engagement is so low, mm-hmm. like so few people our age are voting, that even if we doubled it, which is going from 8% to 16%, we would make a massive ripple.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's not even like some sort of, you know, unfulfillable kind of goal that, oh, we need 100% millennial engagement, which would never happen. We really just need to get like more. Because there's like none right now.
And we outnumber the old people in this country who are voting by a lot.
Yeah.
So that realization for me has been the most uplifting thing in the world, because there actually is a simple solution to this. And obviously, as you get down in your individual, there's work that needs to be done, especially if you're going to run and figure out a way to win without money. That is difficult. But with the internet, if all they're doing is collecting money for ads, we can do that for free. You know, I'm doing a show basically for free, and people do YouTube videos all the time, and we can spread those amongst our own communities and get creative with the way we run. It's how it was supposed to be done. So we can also beat the financial interests by just not needing them anymore.
And we have to do it within the system. This is the opposite of doing what Occupy did. This mm-hmm. is actually getting involved in a political way. So just remember, the next time that you have to go home for some sort of family event, for Thanksgiving, maybe sooner, there's a wedding you have to go to, and like your crazy grandpa is being all racist and he's like being super homophobic and saying all sorts of crazy shit. Gramps is voting.
Yep.
And Gramps has elected officials that represent his interests. Maybe you should be doing the same thing and at least undoing grandpa's vote.
Yep.
Look at it that way, and that might help. All right. Well, I am really excited about this episode. It was so much fun, Jen. I'm so glad that you were able to come all this way to both have a fun vacation in LA, but also sit down at least for this 1 hour with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I was thrilled to come down here. So.
Yay. And everybody out there, thank you so much for tuning in week after week after week. I'm really looking forward. You know what? I'm not. Ha! I just faked you out with an ending. I may edit that or I may just leave it. I didn't do my final two questions.
Let's do them now.
I always forget. Every episode I end by asking somebody two questions, and I need to ask you two questions. The first one is the Depresso one, which is when you're looking to the future in whatever context you'd like, what is the thing that sort of keeps you up the most at night? What maybe disappoints you? What worries you the most? And then on the flip side of that, so we can end on a positive note, what are you most hopeful about for the future? What are you looking forward to?
Well, the thing that keeps me up at night is just environmental damage, because we're allowing these companies to just do whatever they want with fracking and oil spills. I mean, on my own beaches here, I'm coming home and finding tar balls, and that just makes me so angry and upset. And so I feel like we need to get regulations back into play before we ruin everything and cut down all the forests. And like, I really am concerned that we need government for these reasons.
You guys can't see me like massively nodding in agreement over here.
Yeah, I worry about that. But, and I think we kind of covered this, the thing that gives me so much hope is that because so few of us have voted, I really do think we're going to turn this around. I believe that with all my heart, because the people in my age bracket, even if they say they are opposite me politically, once we sit down and have conversations, I'm always able to find common ground with people. We're not from that generation that decided the split into two groups and fight with each other. And that's the generation that's still in charge in the government. I feel like when we get control and when we get our heads out of our asses and actually vote, I am convinced we're going to fix this. And it's going to be a beautiful thing. It's going to be an energy efficient world. It's going to be a cleaner world. It's going to be a saner world. And if we don't let our parents ruin it first, I think it's going to be a beautiful thing.
And it's true. It's even with the third rail issues. Like, how many people do you know that are like in their mid 20s, for example, who are like, I hate fags.
It just doesn't happen
anymore. Like, everybody's like, yeah, well, if you're gay, you should be able to get married. I don't get it. Why is this such a big thing? Like, even those kinds of issues, they don't compute for us. Like, we're on the same page for so many things. Let's actually get back to having real rigorous debate about the things that do differ, mm-hmm. and make decisions that are based on what we think is best for the country and not what's best for ExxonMobil. Yeah. Sorry, Exxon, I've really thrown you under the bus.
They deserve to be under the bus.
But a lot of people do.
They're driving the bus.
Why am I only calling out Exxon? It's true. I agree. All right. Well, before we go though, Jen, which is another thing I totally was remiss to ask, let everybody know where they can find the podcast, how they can reach out to you on Twitter, Facebook, all that good stuff.
Well, Congressional Dish actually has its own app. So I know that podcasts are difficult for Android listeners. So if you just go to Google Play and you look up Congressional Dish, you will find the app, which actually you can access the show notes directly from it. And that's also available for Apple users. And you can find it anywhere that podcasts are found. And I am most accessible on Twitter. That's how Kara found me. Mm-hmm. And you can find me at Jen Briney.
Awesome. Well, everybody, reach out. Tell her what you thought of the show. Definitely subscribe. Start listening. Thank you, Jen. I'm going to do this again. Thank you for joining me this week.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
It was my pleasure, too. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.